3-hour slot. So some of you might have wondered if they had the capacity to sit 3 hours and hear about the Bhagavatam. And you should know that some of us are wondering if we had the capacity to speak for 3 hours without the Bhagavatam, and concluded that we would need some breaks in order to refresh our intelligence, because we might be pushing too hard and then we might reduce our receptivity as the 3 hours went on. So this is what we're going to do. We have 3 hours, a half an hour I'm going to speak and give you a general introduction to the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then we have a 10-minute break, and people are encouraged to go outside and get some air and get into a different environment, but not to get too chatty and exhilarant outside, because you have to come back and settle in 10 minutes, otherwise we'll go way over our time. Then what we have after that is I have some texts which I'm going to give everybody. And I will give them to you, and what I want to do is go through them with you. And I want to show you how, this is just a completely subjective experience, you'll have to tolerate it if it's annoying, but to show you a little bit how to study, how to approach the Srimad Bhagavatam. So this is not a study guide, it's not a system of study, it's more in terms of the spirit, the mood with which you can deepen your sense of relationship with the Srimad Bhagavatam. And then I'm going to give these texts. Each person will have a set. We have a little hearing Srimad Bhagavatam, it's the first Anga, and the series of these texts, and I want you to put them in your book. And then I will give you some time, there'll be some time for writing. And after we have gone through them together, to various degrees, not all of them very thoroughly, but we've gone through different points, then I want you to take them and in your own, the rest of the time, just to write whatever you want to write. If all you can write is, I can't relate to this, that's a big step. Because by doing that, you bring it out into the open. Because we tend to keep what we're not comfortable with. We put it, in modern psychological terms, they talk about how everybody has like a shadow. We see we have a shadow, right? The light is here, I have a shadow. And in that shadow, we keep all the things we're not comfortable with. And some of the things in the shadow are very negative things about ourselves we don't want to deal with. But some of the things are very, very wonderful things about ourselves, but they don't fit in somehow socially to how we see ourselves. And we put them into our, you could say, into our unconscious mind. And there they sit. And we're not aware of them. We have them. They're ours. But they're very, very good things about us. But we're not really... that's not our agenda for now, how we see ourselves, so we don't admit them. And I read one book where this gentleman who was dealing with the public on these matters in his own way, he noted that it was more difficult for people to bring out the good things than the bad things. It was more easy for people to talk about the bad things. I have a problem with this, I'm always like this, I hate myself because I do this, did it, did it, did it. But when you tell them, you know, you have all these wonderful qualities, they go, because I was thinking, why is that? And sometimes it's because it would take some shifting around of things and we're frightened of that. Or it would take a little work. We have to polish them up a bit and we're maybe a little lazy. Or we may have other priorities at our present time and so therefore we think it would be troublesome to deal with those things. So all that is all right. It's not what we're going to discuss. That can be discussed in a different forum, but we're going to allow ourselves to let some of those things come out in our writing in a very safe way, in not just in a general random way, but in connection, in association with the Srimad Bhagavatam and in association with the holy name, so that in this way we can take inroads towards developing, so you can develop your own sense of relationship with these very powerful, completely transcendental angas, because this is the Krishna consciousness process. So we'll have this. Then we'll have 10 minutes break after writing. Then we'll have a half an hour section where I will suggest little groups and I'll just put people in groups. And I want you just to, I'll give you 5 very simple questions, nothing deeply psychological or personal or subjective. Just simple questions, and I want you to talk amongst yourselves about these very simple questions, just so there is some exchange about the Bhagavatam, very simple, And then at the last 30 minutes, then a little break, and then what I want to do is to read some classic verses of the Bhagavatam, because by then you'll be ready to hear them. Because the Bhagavatam is like the most classic of all spiritual literatures. It's like the elite, the topmost of all spiritual books. And this has been acknowledged for thousands of years in the culture, the Vedic culture in which the Bhagavatam was present. Of course, there's always been people who have different tastes, because the Bhagavatam is considered very high, but it's always been acknowledged as very, very high. And Srila Prabhupada took it as his life's work to bring this text to us, so we can understand it a little bit. Of course, we can't understand it, but we can access it, and we can approach it, and we can develop our sense of relating with the Bhagavatam. So the history of the Bhagavatam in brief. Now, I think everybody knows that the Srimad Bhagavatam was written down, it was compiled by Vedavyasa. So Vyasadeva, he wrote it down, and he also taught it. The son of Vedavyasa was Sukadeva Goswami. So Sukadeva was extraordinary. We're talking now about extraordinary personalities, so you'll have to shift a little from the type of people you've met in your life, and you'll have to hear about these very exalted personalities thousands and thousands and thousands of years ago. Very, very elevated. Just like in the Bible, if you read the Old Testament, you'll find that Abraham and Isaac and those personalities lived for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, 800 years, 900 years. So this is a previous time. So we may not be able to find any traces of it now, but that's why we have to hear about it. So Vyasadeva, of course, is an empowered incarnation of the Supreme Lord himself. He's empowered to write this work. And Vyasadeva had one son, and his wife became pregnant with this very, very, very exalted personality. But he was so transcendental, he had no karma. We come out of this into this world because we have some desire, something pushing us out. He had nothing like that. He was completely equipoised. He had no interest in this world. And so as a result, he didn't want to come out of his mother's womb. So this is a bit inconceivable. Somebody becomes a month overdue, 2 months overdue, everyone becomes worried. But he stayed in the womb for years, and he wouldn't come out. And needless to say, his mother was a little inconvenienced. And she was saying, you know, what is this? But he wouldn't come out. He didn't need to come out. And so Vyas, he understood he's already not a baby anymore, and he's still there, and how can I get him to come out? And he tried to reason with him, please come out, but he wouldn't. And finally he went to Dwarka, because this was the time when Krishna was also present. And he was given the suggestion, you read him, you teach him this subject matter, and he'll come out. So he did. He sat down with his wife, and he began to teach him the whole science of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And the little boy within the womb, no longer a little boy, now becoming a young man, he heard this, and it riveted him, because he was free of anything dirty or alternative in his heart other than this. And he became so drawn and attracted to the subject matter that he instantaneously came out of his mother's womb, and he was already a young man, and he walked straight out the door. And Vyasadeva went, wait a minute, first of all you're here, now you're going. And so he ran after him, come back, come back, come back. But he wasn't interested in coming back and living in the world as we know the world, as my father, my mother, and so on and so forth. He was now completely free of any designation, any connection with this world. And so he wandered here and there. A young man, he was around about 16, he was bluish in complexion, somewhat like Krishna, dark complexion. And he didn't even wear clothes. He didn't even cover himself up. And Vyasadeva was running after his son. And Vyasadeva is this great personality, sage, venerated, elderly, fatherly man, his incarnation, all this. He goes running after his son, and his son is walking by some young girls who are bathing in the river, so they haven't got their clothes with them. And when they see Sukadeva go by, they don't even bother. Just in the same way that if some ladies are bathing and a little five-year-old comes by, they don't bother to cover themselves up. But as soon as they saw Vyasa, they covered themselves up immediately in great shyness, because this was the culture. So he was surprised. I'm the one who's so learned. He's just a why don't you cover yourself up? And they said, he doesn't distinguish between men and women. He doesn't know anything about men and women. He's completely innocent. Whereas you're a married man, so that means you have to know this is a woman, this is a man, so we have to obey the rules of etiquette in front of you. So Sukadev, he just walked and he walked, and people thought he was crazy, and some people would throw things at him, and some people thought he was very cute, and they go try to play with him, and they would in different ways interact with him. He was completely on a different plane. His plane, it's described in the Bhagavatam, is called Turiya. Turiya means a fourth dimension. This world has three dimensions. Right? We're always talking about a three-dimensional study or a three-dimensional architectural piece or so on and so forth. There's no fourth dimension, but there is a fourth dimension, and that fourth dimension is transcendental, beyond this world. So Vyas, prior to this, Vyasadeva, he knew that the Kali Yuga was coming, and in Kali Yuga there would be great darkness. You could call it darkness, spiritual darkness, ignorance would be very predominant. And knowing this and having a vision of this, he decided to write down the Vedic literature, because prior to that, just by speaking, like we will speak here, everyone here in the previous time would have memorized everything. I would be speaking from memory, you would memorize everything, you would go and find some students, you would speak to them, they would memorize everything. There wasn't any need to write anything down. Or to speak of a calculator and a computer, so you've got all the time plugged into a machine. There was no need of this, because people's brains were so uplifted and so fertile that just they were so, as per, yes, probably the word fertile, that anything, a conveyance of any subject matter was immediate and complete. But Vyas saw that this wasn't going to be the case when Kali Yuga attacked, and that people would be very much debilitated as a result of the effects of Kali Yuga. So he wrote down the Vedas. First of all, he compiled four Vedas, and each of those Vedas he taught to one of his disciples, and he told them to teach this line and this line and this line. He did all of that. This is very high, subtle spiritual knowledge. Then he thought about the people in general, like ourselves, the women, the ordinary people, what would be good for them. And he thought, and he wrote the Mahabharata. And if anyone has read the Mahabharata, you can see it's very fantastic, but it's full of stories, sort of romantic stories and political intrigue, and a war takes place and so on and so forth. And it's quite intriguing. I know when the children in the Gurukul were young, we used to read the Mahabharata, and they found it very interesting. And within the Mahabharata, for the benefit of everyone, he put like... If you put, say, if you have a valuable diamond, you may not want to just leave it here in case it gets knocked off the table or someone just takes it away. You put it safely. So he safely put the Bhagavad Gita. And within the Bhagavad Gita, he gave all the transcendental knowledge in a nutshell form, in a very primary form. And then after that, he finished the Mahabharata, he finished all of his writings. And you would think he must have felt very pleased with himself. He's done so much for the benefit of everyone, but he didn't. He actually felt very unsatisfied. And he thought to himself, what's the problem? I've done so much and I still don't feel very peaceful of heart. What's the problem? And he was a great person, so he could examine his own interior. And he was thinking, why do I feel like I haven't done anything? And he began to think like this. And then he began to ponder and he thought, about it, and immediately at that moment his guru, who was Narad Muni, came. And Narad Muni asked him, are you satisfied having mistaken the soul for the mind and body? And then he said to him, he told him that you have done a disservice by everything that you have written. And because Vyasa was very, very astute, he could understand these points that were being given, he was being scrutinized. He said, because you have given encouragement to the people in general that if you follow this religious process and this religious process, you'll get this and you'll get this and you'll get that. So you have made their minds more fruitive. That means they will think, oh, if I get this and this and this and this, And they will hardly care for any prohibition. If you say, you must give this up, you shouldn't do this, they won't like that because they are already getting a taste, oh, I can have this if I do that. And so you actually aren't giving them the purest essence of religious principles. And then he told him further, he said, why don't you write something? A text in which you go straight to the most important thing of all the Vedas. You should write a text in which the Supreme Lord is glorified. This is what is lacking. And so when he said this to him, Vyasadeva, we have a children problem. Kitchen problem. So then, at that particular point, Vyasadeva, he sat down and meditated. And he composed after that the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's a very interesting book because you've got the fact that it's composed by Vyasadeva, but it's full of conversations. So as soon as you enter the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first thing that you find after the first three verses of the invocation, and they're extremely profound verses that describe the deep significance of the Bhagavatam text. And then immediately we enter into the scene of a yajna that's going on in Namasharanya. Some people, I don't know anyone here, has been to Namasharanya. Have you been to Namasharanya? Well, Namasharanya is considered in India, it's a place in India, it's considered to be like the hub of the universe. I don't quite know what that means, but it's a very significant place. And these sages, seeing that Kali Yuga was coming and seeing all the ill effects that are going to befall people, they decided to hold 1,000-year sacrifice. This is how long they could live, in order to push back these ill effects and protect the people. And so the head of this assembly, his name was Sutta Goswami. And so Sutta Goswami was seated as the Prabhupada says, he's the chairman. He said the person in charge should be, he said the head, the chairman, he should be elderly, he should be older than everyone else, and he should know a lot. So this was Sutta Goswami. He was seated in the seat, and the sages were about to question him, because they were beginning this sacrifice. So here's Vyasadeva is writing this. So the sages at Namasharanya asked Sutta Goswami 6 questions. So let us hear what those questions were. The first question they asked was, what is an easy way to understand what is the absolute and ultimate good for people? What a nice question. How can we understand what is the absolute? Absolute meaning no harm involved. Not that I do good to you and I do bad to you, but to do good for everyone. How can we understand this? Then they said, men are so unlucky and disturbed. So can you tell us, please, what is the essence of all scriptures? Of all scriptures, what is the essence? So that when they hear this, their hearts will become peaceful and satisfied. This is how they were thinking. These are the questions that they were asking. This is the essence, the basis on which the Bhagavatam rests.
Is it the second question?
The second question was, what is the essence of all scriptures? Hearing this, people's hearts will become satisfied. The first one was, what is an easy way to understand what is the absolute and ultimate good for the people in general. So the second one, what is the essence of all scriptures, hearing which people's hearts will become satisfied? And the third one is, for what purpose did the Lord appear in Devaki's womb? Why did Krishna appear? And the fourth thing they requested was, will you please explain to us his teachings as imparted by previous masters? So I'll read those again slowly so anyone can catch up. The first one, what is an easy way to understand what is the absolute and ultimate good for people? The second one, What is the essence of all scriptures? Hearing this, people's hearts will become satisfied. The third one is, what is the purpose of the Lord? Why did he appear in Devaki's womb? And the fourth one is, please explain his teachings as imparted by previous masters. And the fifth one, this is an expansion on those ones, was, please tell us of the adventures of his various incarnations. Because hearing in the third one is all about Krishna himself. But then they wanted to hear about Lord Nrisimhadev, Lord Varahadev, Lord Vamanadev, all the various incarnations. And the sixth one, and this is a very, very important one for us. They said, now that he has gone, he has left this planet, where are religious principles to be found now? And where can we take shelter? Where have religious principles gone, and where can we take shelter? So if you, when you have written those down, if you look at them, they're very, very healthy and valuable and relevant questions. They weren't asking esoteric kind of, you know, technical questions. Could you tell us the exact date on which so-and-so took place, or how many meridians from here is this and this and this and this. They weren't asking questions that were only relevant to people with a very specific kind of a nature. They were asking questions that were relevant for everyone. And so Sutta Goswami, he offers his obeisances to them. They offer their obeisances to him. And Sutta Goswami offers his obeisances to Sukadev Goswami. Why? Because Sutta Goswami happened to be present when Sukadev Goswami, who heard the Bhagavatam from his father, spoke the Bhagavatam. So he spoke it on one very momentous occasion. So Sutta Goswami offers his obeisances to Sukadev Goswami, and then he answers these questions of the sages in brief. So the first chapters of the first canto are relevant to this point. And the last point, the last question, where have religious principles taken shelter now? This question is answered in chapter 3 of the first canto. So only the first few chapters are an answer to the questions of the sages. And the answer to that question, because this is very relevant, is, this is chapter 3, first canto, so you can look this up at a different time. Text 43. 1343. I'll just read the English. This Bhagavata Purana, that means the Srimad Bhagavatam, is as brilliant as the sun, and it has arisen just after the departure of Lord Krishna to his own abode, accompanied, Krishna is accompanied by religion, knowledge, etc. Persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance in the age of Kali. So we can see, even if we may have some vision, we see all around us people who have lost their vision. Lost their vision doesn't mean that they're all groping or blind. It means they've lost their vision of transcendence, and they think that life is meant for eating, sleeping, enjoyment, frivoling away time, learning things that will make them an economic basis for life in this world, without any sense, without any conception of what goes on after that. Without any question, what about a death? They don't want to know about death. They just want to live life for life's sake. So this is considered by the Bhagavat and by the great masters to be a case of ignorance, darkness. So he says, persons who have lost their vision due to the dense darkness of ignorance in the age of Kali shall get light from this Purana. The light will come. And we see in the early Bhagavatam, there's a picture of somebody holding up, in Svyasa, they're holding up the Bhagavatam like this, and the light coming from it. And in the light you see people doing all kinds of heinous things, and the darkness is all around. So the Bhagavatam is what shines this light so one can distinguish. Otherwise, how will you distinguish? We look left, we look right, we see people doing things. Where people too? How do we know what is actually religious or irreligious? Some people say religious principles means you should do this. Some say this, some say that. How do we know? So, on from here. Sutta Goswami continues to speak to the sages. And he describes about Vyasadeva. And of course, it's very mysterious. There's this, one has to sort of take in the panoramic view of the Bhagavatam. Vyasadeva is writing this. He's writing about Sutta Goswami, describing about him, preparing to write the Bhagavatam, meeting his guru Narada, and Narada telling him, write this down. Write all about the glories of the Lord's pastimes. This is what you must write. So the Srimad Bhagavatam, essentially, the main subject of the Srimad Bhagavatam is Krishna's pastimes. And all the other subject matters are leading up. Now here you can see a picture of Krishna. And we start here with Canto 1, Canto 2, Canto 3, Canto 4, Canto 5, Canto 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. And it is pictured as the first two cantos are like the Lord's lotus feet. So it is said sometimes in the Bible, comes to forget this on the street, until one has a certain amount of faith, one should look at the deity. Now this is a statement, but it has a subtle significance. You should start your darshan when you see the deity of the Lord, you don't look at their face first. Now that doesn't mean, that's not a superstition. Like, don't look at the, oh, you did something wrong. I'm not talking like that. The point is that within the cultured way, one, with a superior person, one goes like this. We see this, as devotees, we're meant to bow down. It was difficult sometimes for us to do this, being not our culture. But in India, you see people, they will bow down. Every morning, I met one friend of mine who lives in Alachua. And she's Indian, and her husband is American, and they have two girls. And she said to me, I'm raising my children in the West. She said, I don't mind this, I don't mind that, but there's one thing I do mind. If they don't bow down every morning to their mother and father, I'll kill them. And so as soon as they wake up, they come in and they bow down and touch the feet of their mother and touch the feet of their father. This is the culture. But it's not our culture. So we can't imitate that because it's out of our culture. But we can understand it. And by understanding it, we can grasp a little of the spirit of why that is. Because in that culture, senior people were worthy of respect. In Western culture, they may be, they may not be. And nowadays in Indian culture, the same. But in Vedic culture, senior people, they followed a lifestyle of discipline. And therefore, they were worthy of respect by those who were following behind them. This was the order. So therefore, they would, even we see, if we see somebody who we respect as a devotee, we go like this, as our little gesture of offering respect, and immediately you see what you're doing, you're looking down. Just by doing that, you look down. You start at the feet, and then one works one's way up. Now, I think, I don't know about you, but I think I would feel if someone was telling me that, and I know I did feel years and years ago, like, that's revolting. What do you mean? You can't have any spontaneity, you can't even look at a person, you know, it's like so restrictive, and I would think so many things. This is all right. You can think those things, but the principle is one of development of faith in regards to the Srimad Bhagavatam. It's not to make you feel like a zombie and a nobody and all kinds of other things that may or may not arise. Admitting my own problems, we could say, but they may be also common to others within our cultural upbringing. We don't like to be told like that. But the purpose is to do a development of faith. So the first two cantos, 1 and 2, considered like the Lord's lotus feet, is considered the most, almost the most important part of this body. You see also in Indian guru tradition, when you see Indians anywhere and they meet their guru, not ISKCON devotees so much, because Srila Prabhupada wanted some protocols for Westerners in place, but they would touch the feet, they would go for the feet. And why? He explained why he didn't want us to get into touching feet all the time. It's because when they touch your feet, They drop all of their sins on your feet, boom, and they become purified. They become relieved of sin by getting the strength from your feet, and they drop them there. So when I myself, I remember, went to Bangladesh with my husband, and been forewarned that the Bangladeshi people, they're Bengalis and they're very emotional, and they've been confined within a Muslim culture, so they're even more grateful and happy to see a Vaishnava, so they're even more in earnest. And when they see you, they just grab your feet. And I was so frightened because I had, you know, knew this, what happens when they grab your feet. And sure enough, this is the first time we went to some place. Hundreds of old ladies came racing towards me, and I was like, sat down, you know, I wouldn't move until I went away. And that's because I looked very strange to them, because it's their cultures like that. A saintly person gives, and a saintly person has to give. It's his duty to give, he has something to give, and he in return accepts their fallenness, and he elevates them. So this is the significance of these first two cantos, that they're very beneficial. The subject matter is very nice, actually, in the first two cantos. Now, part of the second canto, if you take an index and look through it, you'll notice is very technical about the creation, how the world is created. This is one of the subjects that must be in the Bhagavatam. It must be in a Purana. A Purana has 10 subjects that must be there. And I was listening to a tape of Srila Prabhupada in 1966 speaking about this. And he said at that time that he said that there are 10 topics. Now, he put them in his own words. And so what I did was, when I heard him, I stopped the tape, I wrote down what he said, and then I looked at the 10 topics that are actually given in the second canto. Describes what 10 topics are in the Bhagavatam, and I saw that they differ. But I thought it was interesting to take Srila Prabhupada, not because he's superseding them, of course, but because he put that into his own words of feeling, what he felt was the benefit of those 10 topics. And he said, one must know what is the creation. We would think, why must I know what is the creation? He says, you must know what is the creation. It's very important to know this. How it is going on. What is the creation? How it is going on? What are activities? This is 1, 2, and 3. 1, what is the creation? How is it going on? Number 2. What are activities? It's an interesting, what are activities? That one doesn't think like that. One thinks, what are the activities, or what are the activities of? But he said, what are activities? Spiritual knowledge, philosophy, renunciation, and ultimately liberation. And he says, when you understand those things, the creation, how it is going on, what are activities, spiritual knowledge, philosophy, renunciation, liberation, then you can understand the summum bonum. What is creation? How is it going on? What are activities? Number 3, 4, spiritual knowledge, 5, philosophy, 6, renunciation, 6, 7, liberation. Then understand the summum bonum. Summum bonum means the absolute truth. And if you look in the introduction to the Srimad Bhagavatam, the first thing Prabhupada writes when he starts, not even the text where he's translating, but the very, very introduction, the first thing that he says is, what was that? Okay. The very first thing that he says is the conception of God and the conception of the absolute truth are not on the same level. So one day I picked this up, I was looking for something else, I opened this up and I went, what does that mean? I just like, what does he mean? Because it was such a funny thing, it just struck me all of a sudden. The conception of God, the conception of the absolute truth are not on the same level. That means that the conception, not I cannot say what it deeply means, but the idea that we have from our upbringing of God is not the same as what is being spoken of when we hear about Krishna. They're different concepts. And because they're different concepts, when we bring our concepts and then we hear through our concepts, we only get a part of what's being told to us. And as we grow and develop in Krishna consciousness, our concepts subtly alter without any endeavor to alter them. They alter and expand. And as they alter and expand, we get a bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger perception of what. But still, without knowing these things, these are prior things, without having these concepts somewhere in our consciousness, when we hear about Krishna, we can't help but mistake his pastimes for being something like those of men and women and children and mothers and fathers in this world. Why? Because we have no other concepts. These are the concepts we grew up with. So these concepts are ruling us. And the only way they can be altered is by association with pure transcendental knowledge. Or, to make that easier, because we might be sitting here thinking, gulp, I'm not a scholar, I don't think I can take that up. Then Srila Prabhupada says in one purport, Lord Chaitanya makes that a lot easier for us, because we're already considered to be covered by the darkness and the struggles of Kali Yuga. How does he make that easier for us? He makes that easier for us through the process of chanting Hare Krishna through the kirtan. That even imperceptibly, even if you come to the kirtan, you chant, as long as you're not consciously, willingly making offences. Even if you're an offensive rascal, but you come to the kirtan and chant, gradually, gradually, chaito dharpana marjanam, the heart becomes cleansed. And the funny part is that you won't find it every week, regularly on schedule, but you'll find here and there that you'll see it quite visibly and markedly in your own lives, that you'll pick something up and you find as if you've never read it before. It's fascinating. Wow, that's really interesting. And then you think, wait a minute, I read that last week and I thought that was really not at all interesting. And now it's become relevant. It's come into my field of interest and now I can understand it. That's because your concepts have been developing. And by association with devotees based on these angas of bhakti, naturally your concepts will develop and naturally you'll feel. Just like sometimes it can be, I know myself being either a speaker and especially an audience, I think, uh-oh, they're going to talk about things that are way over my power to understand and I'm just going to feel uncomfortable and I don't know about this and so many things. I can feel that way. But if I can listen anyway, my concepts will develop. And Srila Prabhupada, you listen when he talks in places or see when he reads. How many times he says, you're under a misconception. This word comes in all the time. The misconception of I and mine. The misconception of being your body, the misconception, the wrong concept. So one makes spiritual advancement as these concepts are cleared. And this takes place naturally. Okay, so then we have these, Sutta Goswami is speaking the Bhagavatam and the last verse that he spoke was saying that the Bhagavatam would be the light for people who had lost their way in Kali Yuga. Then if we proceed on in our reading, that's in the third chapter of the first canto. As we continue reading chapter after chapter of the first canto, we hear different things. We hear about Narada instructing Vyas and telling him from his own life. He said, what happened to me? I'll tell you my life story and that will help you to get your point. And Vyas becomes really determined. He writes the Bhagavatam. And then, after, this is in chapter 6, after that, it describes how Vyasadeva writes the Srimad Bhagavatam, and he gets this vision before composing it, where he sees that the material miseries of the living being are totally superfluous to one. Just imagine what a gift it would be if any of us could give another one of us the vision that all the things that are troubling us, or you, or me, are superfluous. They're not actually there. They're not actually causes of anxiety. Just imagine what a relief that would be. We're seeking to solve all our problems, just like if you're dreaming that there's a tiger and you're trying to work out how to climb a tree, and you're trying to find an axe, and you're trying to protect yourself. And if somebody was to come and shake you and wake you, and then you'd go, oh, whew, oh, what a relief. I thought I was being eaten by a tiger. What a horrible experience I was having. Thank you. So this is what the Bhagavatam's potency is, to awaken one so they can perceive, they can see that Maya is just like a shadow just behind, and the living entity is eternally, gloriously spiritual. And this is what Vyasadeva was asked to deliver, this message. So then in chapter 8, we meet for the first time in the Bhagavatam Krishna. So we, if you note, from the first canto, chapter 8, through till chapter 10, 8 to 10, Krishna's pastimes are delineated in that order, actually to 12. And then after that we don't hear about Krishna again, right up until just before the 10th canto, because this is where he's going to be actually spoken of in full. Because then in those first 9 cantos, these different subject matters are going to be delivered for the benefit of a very sincere hearer of the Bhagavatam. So Krishna, he is introduced, and he saves Prakrit Maharaj in the womb after the battle of Kurukshetra. Asvatthama, who is angry with the Pandavas, he tries to kill this baby by a method of a brahmastra, which is a subtle method of weaponry. He tries to kill him, and he's saved by Krishna. Then he comes out, the prayers are offered by Queen Kunti, the prayers are given by Bhishma Dev, who's leaving this world, elderly sire of the family of the Pandavas, Kurus. And then Krishna returns to Dwarka, and it describes what Dwarka is like in brief. Then the baby Parikshit is born. And after that, we hear about how Maharaj Parikshit, when he grew up and became a strong king, he met with Kali, and Kali was actually beating a bull, and this was so abominable and prohibited that the king was going to kill him just for this act. But he understood that this Kali, this principle of Kali or degradation, has to take place. And Kali in turn asked him, is there some place that I can stay in your kingdom? I've surrendered to you and said I'm sorry. And he said, you can stay where there are these four irreligious principles going on. And then Kali thought, they're not going on anywhere. What am I going to do? And you rule the whole of everywhere. I've got nowhere to stay. And then the king says, then you can stay where gold is being hoarded. And so Kali stays there. Then we hear how Krishna disappears. And the Pandavas decide also to leave. So they leave. And then Maharaj Parikshit is crowned as king. Actually, that was just before that. I made an error there. And then in chapter 17, he punishes Kali and gives him his rewards. And in chapter 18, he's cursed. He's cursed in a very mysterious way. He loses his temper, which is very uncommon for the king, who's such a noble person. And he disrespects a sage, and the sage's son becomes offended, and he curses the king that the king will die in a week. He'll be bitten by a snake bird. Like a child might say, I hate this person so much. He had the power to do this. And the king was so noble, he could also reverse the curse. But he took it as a sign of the Lord's arrangement, and he said he would not reverse the curse. And instead of reversing this misfortune that had befallen him, he left everything. He took off everything of his, all vestiges of his worldly life, and he went to the bank of the river Jamuna, as it flows near Delhi, Hastinapur, and he sat down and he waited. And because he was a king, an emperor, a great person, So many people came to see him. They wanted to think, what should we say? He has 1 week. What is he going to do with his week? This is a very amazing thing. Like all the newspapers today would come and they'd all sit there and say, this great king, he's given, you know, he did this with his, what? And they want to interview him. He didn't want to talk to anyone. He just sat there and he decided he was just going to fast till he died. And he was going to fix his mind on the Lord and just fast. He gave up everything. So then, as different people came, he had one question. So first we heard how Vyasadeva has written this all down, and he starts with the story of the sages and Suta Goswami, and the sages asked 6 questions. Suta Goswami answered them. After he answered them, he continued talking. So he's spoken all of the first canto about Vyasadeva, about Krishna, about Prakrit Maharaj's life. And then he comes to this point. And the very last verse of the first canto, the very last chapter, is where Sukadeva Goswami meets. He finally comes to that place. He meets the king. And the king asks him one question. This is the king's asks his question. He says, what is the way of perfection for all people? How can everyone become perfect? And especially, he has an emphasis, especially for one who is about to die. Because that was his existential position. He was about to die. So what is the way of perfection for everyone? And especially for one who is about to die. So these may not seem like very, very gripping, urgent questions for one when they're in their 20s. And they may not seem so important in your 30s. And even in your 40s, you might still feel that you've got a lot of energy. But in your 50s and thereafter, you start to be able to realize. And if Krishna kindly gives you a wake-up in some way or another, where you realize that I could die at any time. It's not really like this general understanding that one lives their whole life and dies as an old person. But one could die at any time. Car accident, anything can happen. So this is the gripping question that Prakrit Maharaj is asking Sukadeva Swami. What should one do when he's about to die? And Sukadeva Goswami begins to answer, and that is the whole of the next 4 or 5 chapters of the second canto. And there he begins, interestingly, he doesn't begin with the highest subject. He doesn't say, as one of our quotes will tell us, and we'll give you a break in a moment, one of the quotes he says is he could have gone to the essence immediately. He had got 5 to 7 days. He should just go to the, get to the point. But he didn't. He went systematically through the whole process of how one should come to this summum bonum, the absolute personality of Godhead. So first he explained to him how you can see the Lord like a pantheistic view, how you see him in everything. You can see the trees as the hairs on his body. You can see the sun as his eye. You can see the stacks of bones, just as we were flying down into Christchurch. There's so many mountains. And if you look at them like that, they look like that, as if there's something underneath the skin of the earth. The stacks of bones, you can see the hills as his bones. You can see the rivers as his veins. You can see he gives so many things. You can see the birds as his artistic sense. So he's giving. For somebody who's very far away, who's very materialistic, who doesn't have any interest in a personal relationship with the Supreme Person, even he can see these things. He can learn to see like this. But that's not Prakrit Maharaj. He's not like that. So at the end, after having given this whole list of how you can see in this way, then he says, but you should focus your mind on the Supreme Lord and you should remember him. He gives a message to Prakrit Maharaj as a devotee. And then he proceeds to tell him how the yoga process works. How you can amalgamate the life airs into this, and you can do this, and you can do this. And here's another process for one, the way of perfection. Again, not the one for devotees. And so Srila Prabhupada points out, and in the Bhagavatam it points out, that devotees don't accept either of these two ways. These are not meant for them. They're meant for very materialistic people. So there's a start. They can start on their process of God realization. But again, Sukadeva Goswami tells Maharaj Prakrit, you should focus on the pastimes of the Supreme Lord. So in that way, after that, Sukadeva Goswami asks, Parikshit Maharaj asks a huge amount of questions. And so then the Bhagavatam starts rolling, and then it goes on and on. And at the end of, pretty much at the end of the second canto, where he's talked about the process of creation and time and very technical subject matters, the sages who are listening to Sutta Goswami, they've heard all of this, but just like we might think, this is a little hard to concentrate, I can't figure this out anyway, I need to know it, I guess, anyway, let me try it. But this is still material knowledge, how the creation comes into existence and so forth. So the sages who are listening to the original Sutta Goswami, they say, can we now hear about Vidura? Because Vidura is a devotee, and they want to know about Vidura. Where, what he did, where he went, how he met one sage, Maitreya, and what they spoke about. And simultaneously, as the sages want a change of subject from these very technical, necessary subjects, but ones that we cannot enter into deeply with our heart, similarly at the same time, Parikshit Maharaj also wants to hear about Vidura, and Sukadeva Goswami begins to speak about Vidura and his activities. Vidura being a member of the royal family of the Pandavas, and how he left home when he was insulted by his nephew, which who was Duryodhana, and travelled to many, many places and learnt many, many things, talking to many, many sages. So again, Śrīla Prabhupāda says in the purport that they wanted to hear something more spiritual. So we can say that the Bhagavatam, we can't say the Bhagavatam is material, but we can say that the process of creation and so on, these technical subject matters, are external knowledge. The internal knowledge is how to develop our sense of relationship with the Supreme Personality, Sri Krishna. So I'll stop here. But this gives you a little bit, I know this is a lot of subject matter to fit into a short amount of space, but hopefully some of it you can assimilate. So can we have a 10-minute break now? And everyone should go wherever they feel that they will get an alternative so they can relax.